heart, dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the one.
The John Williams Show with me, Rick Cogan, filling in. And oh man, one of the great things about listening to that song is in a couple of days I don't have to listen to those songs anymore. I'm up to here with Christmas music. But as I do generally around this time of year, I always invite in my friend John Cusack. He has, among many things new in his life, a new book, his first book. I am going to, John, I'm going to read what it says on the back of it about the author, because it does not even come close. It gives some basics here. Father John Cusack was born and raised in the south side of Chicago. He was ordained a Catholic priest in 1970 and served as a parish priest at Mary's Seat of Wisdom Parish, Park Ridge, Illinois. He was also a member of the faculty of Niles College of Loyola University and creator, coordinator, and director of Young Adult Ministry for the Archdiocese of Chicago. He was in residence at Old St. Patrick's Church in Chicago from 1985 until he retired from the active priesthood in 2014. He continues to preside and preach at Sunday Mass at Old St. Pat's on a monthly basis. John, it's always great to see you.
Oh, Rick, it's a delight. You know that.
This book, it doesn't mention your golfing ability or your caddying experience.
Or my golf partner.
Yeah, or your... John and I consider ourselves America's guests.
That's right.
We will put the arm on anybody who happens to belong to a nice club.
That's right.
To play.
That's right.
For free. For free. Thank you, Tom Wells. Thank
That's
you,
right.
various members of Beverly.
Right.
The book, John, and I want to talk about the book and about this amazing, I think, might be your second book, this 8 Days of Christmas thing you've been posting on Facebook. Never Be Ordinary, Wisdom from My Father, by John Cusack, in honor of George L. Cusack, both of whom are featured in a wonderful photograph on the cover of this. You and I have been talking about your dad and what he meant to you for many years now. And you have told, not as artfully as you write, but you have told many of the stories about your dad. And one of the things that initially struck me and has been punctuated throughout the years is the fact that he was just, as you describe him, an ordinary guy.
Right, Southside guy. And died too young, and I was only 25. He was 59, and I thought he had laryngitis because he couldn't talk.
Yeah.
And the doctor said, well, let's put him in, take a look. And he had paralyzed vocal cords, and he was dead in 5 days.
Mm.
And I was 25, and the bottom fell out of my life because I didn't know what was going on.
You were a priest, though.
Yes, I was. A year and a half.
Wouldn't being a priest give you some kind of, I don't know, the whole notion that God had called your dad, even though it seemed like an unfair call?
No, I mean, that wouldn't have been the theology out of which I operated. I'm a human being like everybody else. And when they told me that, he died on a Wednesday, and I walked in the hospital on Monday, and I called the doctor, and I said, Doc, how's my dad? And he said, John, I'll be straight out with you. He's got lung cancer, a tumor in his lung the size of a bowling ball, and he's going to die. So I did, I think, what many, I don't know, or if you call them believers, did. Instead of going into my dad's room, I started heading to the chapel. I was going to bargain.
Yeah.
God, if you do that, I'll do this. And so I literally remember stopping, almost sliding to a stop in the hall. I said, wait a minute, I can't go bargain with God, you know? So I had to figure out, now what am I going to do? And then I remember right there, I didn't need a chapel. I said, you know, gracious God, just help me get through these days. And would you raise to my consciousness the goodness of my dad?
Yeah, but it's a hard thing to do, and I think in doing this book and talking about your dad, the definition of your dad's goodness took some digging, because it didn't, did it not?
It took some memory.
Yeah.
I mean, you're 25, you know,
right.
Come on.
Sure. You know,
and you know it all. And some of the seven pieces of wisdom that are in that little book, you know, they're probably some of them before I was 20 years old, and we know, we've all been teenagers. It's in one, you hear something, it's in one ear and out the other.
Absolutely.
You know, because we know it all. But as I really went through, I suppose you'd call it the grieving process or something. I mean, I just spent a lot of time between my ears thinking about my dad. That's sort of natural. And all this stuff started popping into my head.
One of the stories that I have heard you tell a number of times, and again, John, in reading it on paper, there is not a formality to it, but there is there's a greater impact to it, I think. Maybe I just think that because I'm a writer, and I think everything I write is impactful. But you tell a story in here, chapter one, indeed, that you have told me many times.
Oh, that one's fun.
It is a lot of fun. Jump in. I'll watch out for you. That is the title of the story. It is about you at maybe 9, 8, 10 years old.
Maybe 10. I mean, I was with my friend John Dietrich. May he rest in peace. And I lived at 80th and Polina. He lived at 81st and Hermitage. And we got the crazy idea to take our bicycles and ride out the 96th and Ridge.
Wow.
I mean, that's like going to Bangkok.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because you never left your neighborhood.
Sure,
you know, and here are two 10-year-old guys. And our mother said, yes, I'm sure they regretted that. But then, and we went to this indoor swimming pool at Ridge Park, and we figured a scheme out because you only were supposed to go to one free swim and then get the hell out of there.
Sure.
But we knew how to fold a towel because they would check the towel. And if your towel was dry, they'd let you in for the next one. So we got about three free swims out of one towel. So we did pretty good. But it had to be a Saturday. And because all of a sudden I looked up, we were flopping around in the shallow end of the pool. And there was my dad over in, I would call it the visitor section. And I jumped over because, I mean, I was surprised to see him and, of course, happy. And he says, what are you doing in the shallow end? I said, we can't swim. He said, go down to the other end. Jump in. I'll watch you. I'll watch out for you. So I jumped in, and for the very first time in my life, I could feel nothing under my feet. Wow. I mean, it's really weird when you think about it.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
10 years of life, which is not a long run. But so I jumped in, and I shot out like a rocket right out of a submarine. And they grabbed the side of the pool, and he said, well, you did okay. He said, now jump in, go 3 feet out. Just jump 3 feet out. I said, Dad, I got nothing to hold on to. He said, I'll watch out for you. So I jumped 3 feet out, and I felt nothing and hurried back, held onto the side of the pool, and I probably had a dopey grin on my face because I didn't drown.
Yeah, right.
And then he's giving me this 6 feet. But don't worry. I'll watch out for you. So I do that, and by the end of the free swim, I could go across the width of the pool.
Wow.
And then hurry back. And when I did it, I was so, like, I accomplished
something you're empowered.
Significant. So I ran over, and I said, Dad, I did it. And he said, that's great. And it dawned on me, there was a fence from the ceiling to the floor. If my dad wanted to watch out, he couldn't get through the fence. I never saw the fence. I only saw my dad.
There is an amazing lesson in that. There are so many amazing lessons in John Cusack's life, but also contained in this new book, Never Be Ordinary, Wisdom from My Father. We'll talk about some of the other stories in it and also how this book actually came to be, because it's a very...
Because you bugged me.
Well, I bug everybody. I bug everybody about everything, and this is the first time it's ever turned into a beautiful book. Roe Coleman is producing today. The great Ben Cortez is spending his last week at this station helping me out, engineering today and engineering on Friday again when I fill in for John Williams. So stay tuned. It's John Cusack all afternoon. My guest for more than the next hour is John Cusack, a retired priest, whatever that's supposed to mean. But you got to...
you are stuck on that.
And I am so stuck on it. I am so stuck on it. When John did retire in 2014, I go, what does that mean? We can play more free golf? What does it mean? I mean...
I do not have an assignment, you know... you read there, I directed young adult ministry for 29 years. That's over. You know, I wasn't pastor. That's over. I wasn't teaching in the college. All the things I did under the direction of the archdiocese, you retire from. You know, if you retire someday, you're still going to be a journalist because you're going to write.
Yeah.
You know, and that doesn't mean you're...
Well, I know. I know many, many journalists who do retire from being journalists and never write.
Well, that's... I mean, yeah, and I know people who are clergy, priests who they
never
hang it
preach.
Up. Yeah, right. And I love to preach.
And you still do preach?
Oh, I do at St. Pat's. I was there yesterday.
What did you talk about?
I don't know. I was yesterday.
Promoting the show. One of the great things.
I promoted it last night.
And promoting the book. That's what we do now. One of the great things about you, John, one of the great and amazing things about you is you never overworked your Sunday talks and sermons. I mean, they just came to you, which I still find astonishing.
Yeah, and I got a little scared yesterday because what I was rolling through my head, I completely went in another direction, and I was creating as I was talking, and I was going in a direction I had never thought I would go, just because I never thought it out, and it worked out okay.
Well, I have heard from from hundreds of the parishioners at Old St. Pat's that you inspire in large part, not only because of your sensitivity, but because you speak about things topically. I mean, it is something that's happening, not generally, but often. Something going on in the world.
Oh, I try. Well, because that's where everybody leads their life.
Yeah, you know? Right.
There's a place I'll go for Sunday Mass on occasion in a different state, and it's terrible. Nothing connects with daily life.
They're just platitudes and
it's
cliches.
It's just stuff and people are hungry. I remember a couple of weeks ago, I was at a place. This was after the shooting at Mercy Hospital.
Yeah.
It wasn't even acknowledged.
I find
everybody is, in some way or another, is hurting.
Talking about it, thinking about it.
We lose a police officer. We lose two more this week. And I remember being there, and they didn't even have the police officer's name in the prayers. So this week, before I went to St. Pat's, I said, make sure these two names, when we pray for those who have gone before us, that they're added to it, because everybody, and lo and behold, there was a gentleman sitting. He sits right off the aisle. I know where people sit. I don't know their names, but I know where everybody sits. And he's a Chicago police officer who can only do a desk job. Because he got shot up so bad.
Yeah.
He can hardly walk. He's on a cane. And all I can think of is, my God, if we didn't remember those people who went down, he never would have said anything, but I would have been embarrassed.
Let me ask you, John Cusack, given that, without insulting other people, why do you think someone or a place would ignore that? Because there's got to be some philosophical thought behind it. I mean, they obviously...
No, I just think they forgot. I'll be very honest with you. You know, it's not on their radar screen. But my radar screen, I remember telling somebody, I used to give a lot of talks around the country.
Yeah, well, sure.
On how to do church organization.
Yeah.
And I told people, if you're going to create what we call the prayers of the faithful, that's just prayers out of the... Well, anyhow, I said you should have two source books. Number one would be a liturgical or a religious source book that gives you suggestions. And number two is the daily paper.
Yeah, daily newspaper.
The daily newspaper. Go through the daily newspaper for the last 6-7 days and grab the stories that grab people's hearts, whether for joy or sadness. And those are the things that people bring through doors on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And so I don't, you know, when I preach, I don't think it's a hard job, but I think it's we find divine reality in the ordinary, and I think the ordinary is always the ground for, in using my church language, it's the ground of God.
How do you mean the ordinary?
Ordinary things that happen every day.
Yeah.
You know, encounters we have on the job, in the culture. I mean, this day and age, we're not lacking for things that happen. I mean, I'm a news junkie, and you get tired of it after a while.
But it can also be, and you write in, and we'll get to this in the next hour when you're here, the whole notion of this 24-hour, 7-day-a-week news cycle
right.
is I think, kind of dangerous. Let's never be ordinary. these things were on your mind, and I almost, in the way I used to go in Royko's office in the early morning and would see Mike talking about something, and then you'd go in a little later and you'd be a little more fully thinking about that kind of thing. I sort of saw the organic growth of your fine new book, Never Be Ordinary, Wisdom from My Father. What was the catalyst, John, that took it from you writing about it occasionally on Facebook to thinking about it, to talking about it, to preaching about it, to putting it between covers?
I don't know if there was a catalyst, but I know that it's the last, the seventh chapter, which was really the catalyst. It's the mantra off of which I've lived my life, and the title of the book is the beginning of it. It's Never Be Ordinary. But there was another part to that. Never be ordinary if you ever have the opportunity to be someone special.
Yeah.
And I thought it incongruous where I heard that the first time. I heard it in a bar from my father.
Oh, I thought you were going to say from me.
Well, no. You and I have been there.
Yeah, you've heard some things from me in bars, yeah.
But it was a place called the Green Door at 81st and Western. It had a package goods in the front and a bar in the back. And it was a daytime, and we're sitting watching the Sox game. And my dad had his Schlitz and Hiram Walker, shot Hiram Walker, and I had my Coke, and a commercial came on. And all of a sudden, he sort of rolled to the right on his bar stool. He carried a lot of Schlitz with him. And he just said to me, John, never be ordinary. If you ever have the opportunity to be someone special, roll back and never talked about it again. Mm. Now, Rick, for some wacko reason, that's stuck in my head. And I had to figure out what that meant.
Yeah.
I don't know. I never had the courage or whatever just to ask him. But I think this is where I got the idea. Never be ordinary was don't be like me. You know, I'm a guy who works 9 to 5 for railroad. And after 35 years of loyal service, they gave me another week's vacation. But then I had to figure out, you know, what does it mean if you ever have the opportunity to be someone special? And I knew clearly that that was not power, fame, or money. That was not our roots at all.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
My God, we didn't know anybody, you know, in our neighborhood.
Right.
And so I think I figured it out once. And again, it was probably after he died. And that was, don't spend the rest of your life in a bar. Get out of here. Make something out of yourself, comma. But never forget where you came from. Come back and help somebody else. And well, so that's probably what propelled me towards the priesthood. Help somebody else.
Well, and it's probably what propelled you to putting this between covers,
too.
You know, because look, I mean, as powerful as your sermons or whatever they're, what are they called?
Homilies.
Whatever. You know me in religion. You know, the things you talk of, your speeches, your performance at church, as powerful as they can be, they're gone in a flash.
Right.
No one is recording these things.
And I don't remember them.
We're here with John Cusack for another hour. This has become a wonderful, I think, wonderful for me, Kogan tradition. I'm Rick Kogan filling in for John Williams. We'll get a couple commercials, then we'll get some news, and then we will carry on with the author of the newly published Never Be Ordinary, Wisdom from My Father, John Cusack. Welcome back to the John Williams Show with me, Rick Kogan, filling in on Christmas Eve. John Cusack is my guest for another hour. Wow. And we've been talking about our relationship, which has sort of diminished to the point where we are America's guests and kind of trolling for golf invitations. And we got one.
Just got us one.
So we're finished with Christmas.
That's right.
I would have had John earlier in order for you to buy a copy of Never Be Ordinary, Wisdom from My Father, by John Cusack, in honor of George L. Cusack, who is, of course, John's dad, his late dad. But it wouldn't have done any good, because you couldn't get one, because they're sold out. John, we just keep getting off on different tangents, but obviously someone came to you, someone at Corby Books, based in Notre Dame, Indiana, and said, hey, I'd like to put this together in a book, and you said, okay.
Well, it's more complicated, but it's a good story. It was actually his son. His name is Jeremy Langford. And when he was like 20 or 21, He was the editor of Cardinal Bernardin's Gift of Peace.
Best-selling.
His last book.
And best-selling, too.
And Jeremy sat down with Cardinal Bernardin for hours and has the tapes, I hope, hidden somewhere. And he put together, he edited Cardinal Bernardin's last book, The Gift of Peace. Well, his dad is Jim Langford down at Notre Dame. And he's got this little publishing company, Corby Publishing. And Father Corby was one of the profs at one time at Notre Dame. So this is all incestuous.
Oh, that is a good story, though. Yeah.
And but he put me in touch with his dad, and his dad said, Jeremy, let's do it. And
how did he know about you, the son, Jeremy?
Because
had he heard you? Had he...
Well, there's a part of it I can't tell on the radio. But
okay.
But let me put it this way. I brought Jeremy with me to Cardinal Bernardin's funeral.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he did not have a ticket. I said, you're coming with me. And what does Jeremy do? God bless him. He's 21 years old. He knew the family. He knew Cardinal's oncologist. He knew John, his photographer.
John White.
John White.
Yeah.
And they all knew him.
Wow.
And so it was really an amazing event. And I remember standing next to Jeremy at the end of the funeral mass on the steps of the cathedral as the cardinal's body was put in the hearse and began to move. It started to snow, began to move, and people applauded because they didn't know what else to do.
Oh.
And I stayed in touch with Jeremy, and I encouraged him. I mean, he's got books in his blood.
Yeah.
And we're working on another project. Too. So
the Rick Hogan story?
That's right.
Okay.
You know, that'll be one. Yeah.
Okay, he is smart. But and so he is the one who, and I know it took, I don't want to make it seem too dramatic, but I know it took a little bit of arm twisting to get you to fully commit to Jeremy and the
took a lot of
art.
A lot of arm twisting.
Why, John Cusack?
Because I claim somewhere in the book I had writer's block, but
yeah,
it was
do.
More than that. My self-concept, you know, I can be gregarious, and I can be seen as a public speaker and things like that. But, you know, down deep, there's a lot of parts to us as human beings.
No question.
You know, and one of them to me is I'm unqualified. I could never write. You know, I've hung out with you. I've hung out with Blair Kamen. I've hung out with
Mahaney,
Judy Heverdes, number of people from the Trib.
Sure.
Who I mean, I remember telling Blair Kamen, the architect writer for the Tribune, I don't know.
Pulitzer Prize winning artist.
Yes. And I remember I was with him the week he got the award.
Sure.
But I said, Rick, I don't know much about architecture, but I read you for your use of the English language.
Mm.
He's an amazing linguist.
Sure.
And so I'm supposed to write, you know, I read you and we've talked out articles and different things together. And so I really was intimidated. I'll be very honest. And I figured after a while, what the heck? You know, write it. If it flies, it flies. If it doesn't fly, try to build a different airplane. You know.
So you did you know? Did Jeremy allow you to go through the production process? Because, ladies and gentlemen, I've seen and been involved with a lot of books. This is such a handsome little.
Yeah, it's a little thing.
Thing. It is not long. It is something.
61 pages.
Of 62.
Well, 62.
You're no math wizard. You're a great writer, but you're no math wizard.
That's why I went into priesthood.
62 pages. That's why I went in journalism. And it's just as handsome as can be. You can get it on Amazon. But the amazing thing, Father Cusack, you showed me a text that you received sometime, I don't know if it's earlier today or sometime in the last few days, and it tells you something really nice, doesn't it, John?
Well, it was interesting because I was asking if I could get a consignment of some books because I was going to be doing a presentation. And,
sure.
And this was his comment. He said, I'd rather not get the consignment to you. The fact is that we're out of stock. Our stock is down to 200. We ordered a new printing of 1,500, but with vacations and the time it takes at the bindery, we may not get more until the third week of January. I never seen a book sell 900 copies to individual customers in less than a month. Well, when he wrote this, it was 8 days.
Yeah.
So He said, I'm hoping sales will slow a bit.
That makes him the dumbest, no offense,
I know.
Sir, the dumbest publisher I had ever heard of. Here's my hope that your books start selling less.
Well, until copies. They got to catch up.
Yeah, I get it.
They are in print because Amazon is accepting orders.
Amazon has. So or that's where to order the book, ladies and gentlemen. Never Be Ordinary. It's 62 pages of wisdom and sensitivity from Father John Cusack.
I think, Rick, too, and I'm going back to one of your questions. It's not so much about my dad. It's common sense
stuff.
You know, my guess is those seven bits of wisdom, we've had a parent, a teacher, a coach say a similar thing in their own language.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, I remember when I was in my first parish, I worked with a lot of high school kids. And some of the ones who'd come to see me with the most dilemma were the very smart kids. Because the pressure was on them, both from their parents. Achieve, achieve, achieve.
Oh, yeah.
You got to get in the best school, and on and on and on. And I figured, boy, it must be hard to have a parent like that. Because I was an ordinary student.
Yeah.
And what did my dad say? Try hard. You know? And the problem is that mantra stayed with me to this day. Try hard. I mean, I can't mail it in. You know that.
I know that.
And you can't mail it in either. If you're going to write an article,
but
it's going to be Kogan's finest. And if I'm going to put a talk together, it's going to be my best shot.
Oh.
Because I have to try hard.
What was it like, John Cusack, when you, I have asked this question of hundreds of authors, what was it like, first-time authors, what was it like when you first saw your words between hardcover?
Well, I'll reveal it. I told you
a
few minutes ago.
Well, I'm
asking. I know what
you're asking.
I want
to see how honest you are.
The book arrived, it would be 3 weeks ago. Today's Monday. 3 weeks ago last Thursday. And there was a package on my front porch, and I had a hunch. And I opened it up, and I looked at it, and I started to cry. That's me. There's an emotional side of me. And
John, I must tell you, that's 90% of all authors of their first books. Many are weeping, but I get it.
But, I mean, to see a picture of my dad and to realize that I've had the opportunity now to give an ordinary guy who died entirely too young, and I'm still angry that he died.
Sure.
I got him some airtime, you know, and there'll be people who will pick up. I got an email yesterday from someone who wrote all the notes, already put them on his fridge, that these are going to be the things that are important to me. Well, it's not. It's my dad. It's on some guy's fridge.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, of course I know.
My dad must think I'm a whack job. Well, he knew that anyhow. But
Now, do you think, given your religious beliefs, that your dad knows what you've done down here and have seen this?
I hope he only knows the good parts.
He's embarrassed in heaven saying, my son is hooked up with some weird journalist who makes him do these weird things.
I remember the day you told me, you said, I am writing an article, and come on, we're going to have a drink because you're going to be my theological consultant.
Yeah.
And I said, Rick,
theology's
hit a new low.
I mean, newspapers are in trouble these days, Father Cusack. Newspapers are in trouble. We got to take a commercial break. We'll be back. John's going to be here all the way until 2:30. Stay tuned. Christmas just ain't Christmas without the one you love. New Year's just welcome back to me, Rick Kogan, filling in for John Williams on this Christmas Eve. And as I have done, boy, for a lot of years in a row, sometime around this religious commercial holiday, invited my friend John Cusack in here. This year we've been talking about Never Be Ordinary, Wisdom from My Father, what I am going to call the best-selling 62-page collection of his feelings about his late dad, who died when he was 25 years old. John writes in the book, and as you just said, Father Cusack, do I have to say retired Father Cusack? Okay, yeah, shut up, Rick. Just say anything.
That's
I know. I know. You're getting sick
Nobody's
of this.
Paying attention.
Like, once a Marine, always a Marine. Once
That's
a priest,
right.
always a priest.
Right.
John wrote that inside the walls of his family's third-floor apartment in the three flat, and later inside the small two-story three-bedroom house, that the wisdom of my father was passed on to me. That wisdom consists of these sentences. Jump in, I'll watch out for you. Never turn down an opportunity. If I were him, I wouldn't fight for them either. Are you okay? I always admired those who didn't smoke. Try hard. And finally, and perhaps most profoundly, never be ordinary. If you ever have the opportunity to be someone special, the try hard, John, there is so much in those two words. And he instilled that in you about school, about play, about life, everything.
About life, try hard, you know. And I thought it was a great piece of wisdom when it finally came back to me. And
how did it come back to you?
You know, I don't know when it did.
Yeah.
But, I know when it did. My mother, may she rest in peace. There's another story there. What a character she became. I found a box of about 200 letters my dad sent me when I was away at school. Now, what made it remarkable is that my mother, being very German, she threw out everything. And if I was over at her house and she was in one of those moods, I'm surprised I didn't go with the garbage. You know, get them out of here. We got to keep going through life. Well, for some reason, she kept this. And I pulled one of them out, and I read it one Sunday at the beginning of my talk at church. And the two words, try hard, were at the bottom of the page. And he said, I hear you have exams coming up, and then you're going on retreat, and then you're coming home. Try hard. Love, Mom and Dad. And for some reason, that day, try hard was like a neon. And it dawned on me, that was the encouragement, the type of encouragement I always got from him. You know, you don't have to be perfect. He knew I was never going to get A's and B's. I mean, I made the bell curve possible. You know, I always thought that the bright guys in our class owed me beers or dinner or something.
Free golf.
Yeah, I mean, if they were at a 90, I mean, I pushed them up to the A. You know, I was very important in their life.
Were your parents surprised, and or how did they react when you told them, your parents, George and Florence, that you wanted to be a priest?
I don't know. I thought it was like water off a duck's back.
How old were you?
I was only 12.
Okay.
You know, I was a boy genius, and I turned out to be an illiterate adult. I skipped a grade in grade school. I went 7 years. We had an accelerated program at Little Flower Grammar School at 79th and Honorary, and all of us, only one 7 years, and the pastor, Monsignor McMahon, really believed that high school should only be 3 years.
Wow.
But he held back because of the socialization piece. So I was a year and a half younger than my classmates. So they're 14, I'm 12, you know. So we started high school. And the high school seminary was, you've got this ridiculous idea of what a priest would be, as you have a ridiculous idea about what anybody can be.
Yeah, right.
You know, all of a sudden you think you're Charles Dickens if you can, you know, write on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And you're certainly not. But as I went through the program, it was 12 years, high school, college, and 4 years of graduate school. I remember, and I still laugh about it, what my dad would say to me. Now, John, if you ever want to leave, that's okay. He did the reverse kind of thing.
Sure,
you know,
he said, reverse psychology.
Yeah, they never wanted to be pushy people. I don't think pushy towards anything.
Right.
They wanted their son to make choices. But they wanted to know that if you don't want to do what, you're not disappointing us.
Interesting.
And so, I mean, he would say it maybe every couple of years, and I had the same dopey grin on as I do today. You know, it's okay now if you want to leave. But, and then the day I was ordained was the first time I saw him cry.
Wow.
I mean, he was a tough Southside drinking.
And I know he didn't talk much, but what did he say that day?
Nothing.
Nothing. But
congratulations, threw his arms around me, gave me a kiss. And
but certainly in those tears,
I could feel the tears.
Yeah.
And wow. And believe it or not, he only cried twice. He cried a year and a half later on Christmas morning.
Why?
Because of the gift I gave my mom and dad. Gift giving for me at Christmas is very, very important, because I'm not going to get somebody a pair of socks. I have to think about the person. And sometimes that takes a long time for me. And I try to find some gift that symbolically speaks to a friendship or a family member. They may not get it, but I get it. And Rick, it goes into my religious tradition. You know,
yeah.
We've got the three kings bringing gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Well, they were symbols. And they were trying to say to this little child, this is who we perceive you to be. So in Christmas of 1970, it was little I know it was going to be the last Christmas with my dad on this earth. I used to always bring home lots of boxes. My mother liked lots of boxes. I don't know why, but you know, she felt abundance. But that day, I brought home a tie box. That was it. I told him to sit down, and I handed him, I said, here's your Christmas present. And my dad looked at me, what's this? Well,
was it gift wrapped or just?
Oh, yeah. No. This was big. This is the real deal. And inside were two airline tickets to Miami and Nassau, and a week's worth of hotels in Miami and Nassau. And the reason they were there is, for the last 5 years prior to that, they stopped taking a summer vacation because I went to work at Angel Guardian Orphanage up at Ridge and Devon for $4 a week. So the money they would have used on vacation, we were a simple family.
Yeah.
They directed towards me and my schooling, and they cut back. And so what I wanted to do was a gift of time and vacation that they had given to me. And he opened it up. He saw it. I had a letter with it, and he cried. And 10 months later, he was dead.
Did they ever get to go on that trip?
Oh, yes, they did, and I met him for part of it, but only a part of it because I wanted it to be their time.
Wow. That is a remarkable story. Perhaps that can inspire some of you people out there, but most of you have probably shopped already. But you do, John Cusack, write about the whole notion of your day six of Christmas on your Facebook page. You write a great deal about that. The name is John Cusick, C-U-S-I-C-K. I know most of you are members of Facebook. So log on there, and I'm going to talk about some of the other things that he wrote about and what inspired you. You wrote, John, you don't have to keep looking this up. I'll take it from here. You wrote, beginning tomorrow and continuing for 8 days, I would like to share my thoughts on the wonderful symbols and meaning that are part of the magic of the Christmas story. I want to do this for my own benefit primarily. That is a marvelously selfless act, but I think literally, and I know our mutual buddy Catherine thinks so too, there's another book in in your thoughts about Christmas. I'm going to share and ask you to elaborate a little on some of those during the next half hour. The first one is just an astonishing one, I think. It's Let There Be Light, and I have I have ever been fascinated because we both, and many of us of a similar age, have lived through a Christmas that has become so much more physically exuberant, meaning more lights, more trees, more. I remember when they first put the lights up on those Michigan Avenue trees decades ago, and now there's a huge parade, and you make this wonderful point that it is kind of fighting the darkness. I want you to end this half hour with telling me how proud you are of this book that you can order now at Amazon, Never Be Ordinary, Wisdom from My Father. I know you were proud for yourself, and I know you were proud of your writing, but I think the real meaning of this thing is you're happy for your dad.
Oh, I am. You know, Rick, there's a part of me that can be real shy, you know.
Oh, I know, I know. May not seem so to you people who've been just listening for an hour, but yes.
But I don't need accolades and attaboys.
I know.
But as I said, when I opened the box and saw that cover for the first time, I cried because there was my dad. And all of a sudden, somebody who's been dead for 47 years is getting some airtime. And on top of that, you know, he wasn't a public speaker. He didn't have a fancy job. He died in the saddle. We would take a vacation in the summer, but you had to hurry back because you couldn't, you know, miss work and every other kind of thing. And am I proud? I don't know. I'm happy.
That's better.
You know, that it's better. Done. Thank God.
Actually, it is better to be happy.
I'm happy that I overcame some of my own inabilities.
Yeah.
I never thought I could do this. You know that.
I know.
You know, I said to you many times, Rick, I can't write. And I couldn't. But then I did.
Oh, yes, you can.
But
you will read about some more of John Cusack's writing because the stuff on Facebook, and I'm not a huge fan of Facebook, but it is worth visiting Facebook to visit what John has to say about this very season we're celebrating tonight and tomorrow. The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet. Weekday mornings at 7:20 on 720 WGN. Smart speaker users, of which there may be many thousands more after tonight and tomorrow, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. It is 2 o'clock, and here with the news, Don, take it away. I am in here with Father John Cusack, who not only is the author of a recently published fabulous book, not just A Great Christmas Gift, A Great Gift for Any Day, Never Be Ordinary, Wisdom from My Father, by John Cusack, in honor of George L. Cusack. His mother's name was Florence. John, you've done, there's something also that we talked about, how you cried when you first saw the book printed, dumped on your porch. There's also something empowering about it. And you must have heard from a number of people, wow, John, this is a terrific book. You're a fine writer, yes?
Well, yeah, you know, people have been appreciative. And the greatness today, Rick, of one of the positives, let's put it this way, of social media or whatever you call it, is you get texts and emails and Facebook comments.
Yeah.
And it's cracked open a lot of things in people. A friend of mine who I have a great admiration for, he said, I sat down and I read the book. It didn't take me long. He said, but now I made a decision. I'm going to go back each day and reread one chapter.
Nice. What
just
a good idea.
To take it in. And and my cousin, Madeline, with whom she and her husband and extended family, I'll be with them tomorrow on Christmas. Her daughter put her kids to bed. She has five. And sat down and read it. And she said, this is certainly something that I will read parts of it to my children.
That's a great idea.
And
that is
but then she
idea.
Had a comment that was more impactful. She said, you know, when I left teaching to raise my kids, I really began to feel I was just an ordinary person. She said, but I read what you wrote and realized I'm not ordinary. I'm raising kids. You can be a role model. You can be a parent. You can inspire. And you know, when you and I have talked about Fiona,
sure.
You know, she loves Daddy Rick.
Yes, she doesn't call me that anymore, though.
It's that's too bad.
One of the great tragedies in my life that she stopped calling me Daddy. It was the cutest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, she might go back to it when you're going to have a few adult beverages with her. Hey,
yeah, that's
get
fair.
One for Daddy Rick.
Oh, that'll be the day when I say, Fee, you're 21, yeah, let's go drinking. Yeah, that'll be the day.
Oh, I want to be there.
Oh, well, oh, my God. You know, I'll probably be in a wheelchair. If
I don't care. I'll roll
if
you
I can,
in. I just want to be there.
I can't even talk at that point. You have talked. Talking about writing, you decided some days ago to post on Facebook your thoughts about this Christmas season,
yeah.
About gift giving, about light, about you know, Christians beginning a culture of their own.
Right, counterculture.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Christians were counterculturalists. And, you know, there's some great lines in here. You write the number three in this gathering is swaddling clothes. And you write, do you know who was wrapped in swaddling clothes at his birth? Time's up. King Solomon was wrapped in swaddling clothes. The point you're making is that God's people are born wrapped in love.
And they are royal. You know, we are not chopped liver.
Yeah.
And I brought it up because the image of swaddling clothes for me, for some crazy reason, well, they're wrapped in, you know, they're poor people, they're in a stable because there's no room in the inn. And
well, that was my image until about 4 hours ago when I read this thing.
Yeah, and well, we, you know, we got any rags around here? We'll wrap, you know, the newborn.
Yeah.
And said, no, swaddling clothes. It's Solomon, David's son, was wrapped in swaddling clothes, royalty and wrapped in love. And I must admit, and I think I put it in that little writing, that because of Facebook, more times than not, you'll be able to see a child.
In the first few minutes, the first few minutes of life, wrapped in one of those white hospital blankets and gently placed for the first time in the arms and on the chest of mom. I never get tired of seeing that picture and entering into that moment. That is an intimate, that's an amazing thing about this social media. That's an incredibly intimate moment.
The little child is wrapped in swaddling clothes.
Yeah.
And that's the story going to be told throughout Christianity tomorrow morning and tonight.
Yep.
It's not a poverty thing. It's a love thing. It's a love story.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? No question. Then day five is a very, I think, very provocative, interesting one. It is called Two Saviors, Pick One. And you write in here, John, with a great insight that division with civility was a great hallmark of America. And that's a little fractured now, isn't it?
It's over. But what I write in there were two examples of division with dignity. President Reagan and Tip O'Neill could go nose to nose and jaw to jaw. But when the workday ended, they would sit down and have an adult beverage together.
Yep.
And when President Reagan was shot and he was in the hospital in D.C., who came and knelt by the side of his bed and prayed for him?
Tip O'Neill.
But Tip O'Neill. Were they enemies? They were political. But they weren't. There was no meanness as there is today, and ugliness and division. How many tables tomorrow, Christmas Day, will people have to, they'll be walking away from the table with bloody lips and bloody tongues.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because you can't say anything because you don't want to disrupt but we're so divided.
Yeah.
And that's not the Christmas story.
No, the Christmas story is civility.
We're going to find a way to take our differences and respect our humanity.
We'll continue on talking about some of John's writings on Facebook in addition to his Never Be Ordinary book after a short break.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Yes, please try to do that. I am finishing up my hour and a half with John Cusack. Retired priest, but still a whatever that means, from Old St. Pat's, talking about his book Never Be Ordinary, which you can order from Amazon as we speak. I'm sorry you won't be able to give it for a Christmas present, but you might be able to give it for a New Year's Day present. You'd certainly give it for an Easter present or a Valentine's Day present or all the other strange holidays that come up in between this thing. Since you're an expert on the many, many things I don't know anything about, what's behind it? Many people celebrate Christmas Eve, and many others celebrate on Christmas Day, and I suppose some celebrate both days. Obviously, Christmas Day is the day that Jesus was born, and the 25th is his birthday.
Commemorated. Right.
What is the philosophical difference between, or is it a social difference between celebrating Christmas Eve, gathering the family, or celebrating Christmas Day? Is it just arbitrary?
I think it's just developed into more of a popularity. But some cultures, for example, the Italians on Christmas Eve, do not eat any meat. It's all fish. And there's other cultures who have traditions around Christmas Eve that lead to Christmas Day. So it's a type of, not fasting, but just special foods. My mother lived in a six flat, and the people who owned the building lived below her, and they didn't speak any English. They're Italians, but they would invite my mother down, and my mother loved it because she was fascinated by all these foods. It was a feast, but no meats. It was all fish. And so that led them into Christmas Day. So I think that's really part of it. And I think in the Catholic culture, Christmas midnight mass is the only midnight mass in the entire year.
Well, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, and that's changing now.
Why?
People are getting away from it. Oh,
it's too hard on people.
I'll get in trouble for this one, but you know,
you're retired.
I know.
You get in trouble.
Yeah,
what are you doing?
They can't take my Social Security.
Say Rick said it.
They can't take my Social Security away. They say, well, you know, the people want it earlier. No, I don't think the people want it earlier because Christmas midnight mass it's part of Catholic DNA.
Yeah.
I just don't think Father wanted to be up till 1:30. But
you're not going to get in trouble for that. I mean,
well, you don't know the culture. But
maybe,
anyhow.
Maybe thank God,
yeah, I know,
so to speak.
You can say free at last. but I think that's where it all started.
Yeah.
And I think today, in many ways, for example, at St. Pat's, beginning at 3 o'clock this afternoon, there will be 6 Christmas Eve masses, 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock, 3 at each, and only 4 tomorrow morning. There'll be 6 Christmas Eve masses, then midnight mass, that's 7, and 4 masses tomorrow. They will have 11 Christmas services.
How many people going to these many masses are regular churchgoers?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't ever worry. My first pastor told me, he said, we don't look at it that way, John. He said, come on, let's give them the best Christmas worship that we can. Let's let people see the value of who we are as a tradition. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? We're in sales. You know, we're not to judge people.
Yeah.
You know?
What do you think? There's so much, and a lot of it is in your writing on Facebook. You write about Christmas trees. You write about the Mary being still missing from a lot of this.
Merry.
Yeah, because of the
happiness of the day.
24-hour news cycle.
Right.
What do you, John Cusack, to get very, very personal, what do you celebrate about Christmas? And does it ever vary? I know you were celebrating or commemorating the birth of Christ.
Yeah. Tomorrow, it will be... I'll be very conscious that we have a counterculture story. And I need to wrap my arms around that story tomorrow. Because the story that we are hearing and that we are telling the world is not a healthy story right now. For me. I only can speak for me.
Oh.
And I've lost perspective. And it's because I watch too much news.
Yeah.
3 papers in the morning, scan every kind of thing. And so none of the stories out of our culture ends. Now, this is going to be a very religious sentence. We end our gospel readings by saying, this is the gospel of the Lord. You don't hear that on CNN or Fox. This is the gospel of the Lord. We have another story. And we have a story that's got 2 saviors. One is a Roman emperor. And one is a child who brings peace to the world. We have 2 pieces. How does an emperor get peace across the Roman Empire? With an army. They'll kick the bejesus out of everybody.
Yeah.
That's why there was a census to figure out how many people we got. We got to tax them to keep the army going. And then at the end, it's, I have good news. A savior is born. Peace to those of goodwill. In the Hebrew tradition, peace meant the healing of relationships.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And all you got to do is see a police officer as I walk up Michigan Avenue this afternoon. They're armed to the hilt. Because what? They had another name at one time, a peace officer.
Yeah.
And is that it? Not for me. There's another one. Thank God for them.
Sure.
And I thank them every day these days.
I know you do.
I always thank you for watching over us. And they look at you like, you know. But they don't hear that. They hear all the nonsense.
Well, they never hear it, yeah.
But I am about the healing of relationships. I couldn't do it in my own family, but the past doesn't come back.
Right.
But I really believe that is the counterculture understanding that will be very important to me tomorrow.
Yeah.
Very important.
Are you going to speak tomorrow?
Yeah.
Do you know?
9:30.
here is the interesting thing. I mean, things are coalescing up here, and you're going to spend from 3 o'clock on today going wherever you go and doing whatever you do. But that writing pressure, that performance, I don't think you've suffered performance anxiety, but that performance pressure is always there. I think it, much like, and this is high praise for you, like sitting in Royko's office early in the morning, hearing him talk about what he's thinking about has to coalesce into your...
Right, to my final product.
Yeah.
As you and I know, I don't work off of notes. And
I know.
I haven't done that in 48 years. So it's...
That's a tightrope walk, I got to tell you.
I'll admit, I've told people this all the time. I said, I'm very, very nervous before I begin to preach.
Yeah.
Well, you don't look nervous. I said, I didn't
you
ask
seem
you.
Nervous.
I didn't ask you how I look, you know, because it's my dad talking. Whatever you do, give it your best. I can't mail it in, you know?
I know.
Like I said, when I preached yesterday, where I was going, I threw out and went in a completely different direction.
When? How soon before you?
3 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
So it was almost a kind of spontaneous.
You're always spontaneous, because I never have a complete thing in my head.
Right.
Yeah.
And how long do they last?
Too long sometimes.
That's not for you to judge. What do you mean?
But see, I work off of another principle of my father. God, I wish you would have met, because I think both of our fathers
I would have liked
my dad.
Your dad
said to me, for God's sake, I don't care when you begin, just end on time, would you? You know, and I mean, it's almost like he was a radio engineer, you know, just end on time. So he didn't care when I started, but he wanted to make sure that he only got 45 minutes, or I got 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Now I stretch it about an hour and 10, but.
Well, you have done a remarkable job in. I think of this never be ordinary wisdom from my father, not as only a gift to people out there who like and appreciate good writing, but as a kind of gift to your dad, because you and your dad were, you know, you didn't sit there, you didn't go to bars all the time, and you were little, you didn't talk, he wasn't a big talker. It's difficult to share. This is sort of a continuing kind of, this is a kind of new conversation you're having with your dad in this book, I think, John.
And since I put it together, Rick, other stories have come back.
I'll bet.
They've come back from bars, because I would sit and listen.
Yeah.
That was my dad's health club. Come on.
Sure. You know, I know.
You know, you grew up in Old Town.
Yeah.
You didn't press the flesh over on North Avenue. Your old man went and had a beer.
Absolutely.
I mean, you told me that the night you were born, he was out with Studs Terkel.
Well, see, he wasn't out with him. I mean, he was at the hospital for a moment, and then Studs.
Well,
yeah, that there's a side. See, this is now a generally great writing. It's like, yeah, he was out with Studs Terkel. Your mother couldn't find him. You were born in a manger, Rick. You were all alone.
It was
terrible.
Said that.
No, I get it. I get it. But I think, you know, that's part of what this. It is a very, very enjoyable read.
Oh,
it's not. The kind of like, learn these lessons and you'll be a better person. It's not a self-help book.
Help.
It's an explore life book. John Cusack, it is, as you know, it is ever, I don't remember how we met, but I thank God, and you know how I feel about you, God.
Watch out.
Hey, what's going to happen?
Lightning
is easier to strike here than it would be in the basement.
It's quicker than downstairs, 18 floors up.
With big windows, but Ben Cortez is last week. I can't afford for him to be taken out. Enjoy today, enjoy tomorrow, and enjoy every day onward. And keep me posted on the sales of this book, because it's something of a phenomenon.
And as a listener to WGN, can I thank Ben?
Yes!
Because as I mentioned earlier, all of you people on this station are like family to those of us who have WGN on all the time. And if I've heard the name Ben Cortez once, I've heard it 10,000 times in all the 30 years he's been here. So, Ben, on behalf of your listening public, thank you for the gift you've brought to this great station.
Wow.
And may the rest of your life bring you great success.
That is so nice.
Thank you.
That is the nicest thing.
Appreciate that. Yeah.
That is incredibly nice. The new generation is in here, too, and producer Roe Coleman, and it is my honor to work with both of you. You'll hear me And David Royko, read a couple Mike Royko stories as you're going to your, wherever you're going now. So stay tuned. John Cusick, thank you.
Thanks, love Rick. You. Merry Christmas.
You too, as they say.
Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Hitch up your reindeer.
I like that song. Roy Coleman, producer extraordinaire, selected that music. A couple of weeks ago, I had David Royko on the show, and we were talking about his dad, a fellow who you might remember named Mike Royko, and how Mike, for all of his weird tough guy image, was actually kind of a softie at heart. And he wrote what is, to my mind and to David's mind, and the minds of many of you, because you said, play those again, play those again. Two of the most remarkable Christmas columns ever written in a daily newspaper, right up there with the much shorter Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus. Here am I reading Mike about a couple in modern-day Chicago named Mary and Joe. Mary and Joe were flat broke when they got off the bus in Chicago. They didn't know anybody, and she was expecting a baby. They went to a cheap hotel. But the clerk jerked his thumb at the door when they couldn't show a day's rent in advance. They walked the streets until they saw a police station. The desk sergeant said they couldn't sleep in the cell, but he told them how to get to a welfare office. A man there said they couldn't get regular assistance because they hadn't been Illinois residents long enough. But he gave them the address of the emergency welfare office on the west side. It was a 2-mile walk up Madison Street. Someone gave them a card with a number on it, and they sat down on a bench, stared at the peeling green paint, and waited for their number to be called. 2 hours later, a caseworker motioned them forward, took out blank forms, and asked questions. Any relatives? Any means of getting money? Any assets? Joe said he owned a donkey. The caseworker told him not to get smarter, he'd be thrown out. Joe said he was sorry. The caseworker finished the forms and said they were entitled to emergency CTA fare to County Hospital because of Mary's condition. And he told Joe to go to an Urban Progress Center for occupational guidance. Joe thanked him, and they took a bus to the hospital. A guard told them to wait on a bench. They waited 2 hours, and then Mary got pains, and they took her away. Someone told Joe to come back tomorrow. He went outside and asked a stranger on the street for directions to an Urban Progress Center. The stranger hit Joe on the head and took his overcoat. Joe was still lying there when a paddy wagon came along, so they pinched him for being drunk on the street. Mary had a baby boy during the night. She didn't know it, but three foreign-looking men in strange, colorful robes came to the hospital asking about her and the baby. A guard took them for hippies and called the police. They found odd spices on the men, so the narcotics detail took them downtown for further questioning. The next day, Mary awoke in a crowded ward. She asked for Joe. Instead, a representative of the Planned Parenthood Committee came by to give her a lecture on birth control. Next, a social worker came for her case history. She asked Mary who the father was. Mary answered, and the social worker ran for the nurse. The nurse questioned her, and Mary answered. The nurse stared at her and ran for a doctor. The doctor wrote postpartum delusion on her chart. An ambulance took Mary to the Cook County Mental Health Clinic the next morning, where a psychiatrist asked her questions and pursed his lips at the answers. A hearing was held, and a magistrate committed her to the Chicago State Hospital. Joe got out of the House of Corrections a couple days later and went to the county hospital for Mary. They told him she was at Chicago State and the baby had been placed in a foster home by the State Department of Children and Family Services. When Joe got to Chicago State, a doctor told him what Mary had said about the baby's birth. Joe said Mary was telling the truth. They put Joe in a ward at the other end of the hospital. Meanwhile, the three strangely dressed foreign-looking men were released after the narcotics detail could find no laws prohibiting the possession of myrrh, frankincense, and frankincense. They returned to the hospital and were taken for civil rights demonstrators. They were held in county jail on $100,000 bond. By luck, Joe and Mary met on the hospital grounds. They decided to tell the doctors what they wanted to hear, and the next day they were declared sane and were released. When they applied for custody of Mary's baby, however, they were told it was necessary for them to first establish a proper residence, earn a proper income, and create a suitable environment. They applied at the Urban Progress Center for training under the Manpower Development Program. Joe said he was good at working with wood, so he was assigned to a computer data processing class. Mary said she'd gladly do domestic work. She was assigned to a course in key punch operating. Both got $20 a week stipends. Several months later, they finished the training. Joe got a job at a gas station, and Mary went to work as a waitress. They saved their money and hired a lawyer. Another custody hearing was held, and several days later, the baby was ordered returned to them. Reunited finally, they got back to their two-room flat and met the landlord on the steps. He told them Urban Renewal had ordered the building torn down. The City Relocation Bureau would get them another place. They packed, dressed the baby, and hurried to the Greyhound bus station. Joe asked the ticket man when the next bus was leaving. "Where to?" the ticket man asked. "Anywhere," Joe said, "as long as it's right now." He gave Joe three tickets, and in 5 minutes they were on a bus headed for southern Illinois, the area known as Little Egypt. Just as the bus pulled out, the three strangely dressed men ran into the station, but they were too late. The bus was gone. So they started hiking down U.S. 66. But at last report, they were pinched on suspicion of being foreigners in illegal possession of gold. That is just, I hadn't read it in some time. That is just inventive. It's Chicago. It's it flabbergasts me, David.
Well, and also one of the things about Dad, every line. I hate to use these kind of analogies. It always sounds, to like hyperbole, but it's like, he always reminded me of Mozart. You don't change a note. It's like every single line from first sentence to last is there for a reason, and everything is built upon everything else.
And it also tells you this whole, everybody has the notion that Mike sat down at a typewriter or a computer and just the stuff just popped out like this. He worked incredibly, like a craftsman, a real craftsman. It does not come easily. I have ever thought, are a talented writer yourself. You have an ebook now available. You can go to davidroiko.com. It is the Chronicles of Ben book, which tells a, I think, heart-wrenching but honest story about David and his wife, Karen, and their son, Ben, who is autistic and who now lives in Cleveland and had to leave the home where his brother, Jake, also lived. It is, check it out. It's an ebook, and it's a couple bucks, and you will find out what a terrific writer you are. I've always thought that, David. And your dad would be proud of this, because I followed the Chronicles of Ben ever since you wrote a Tribune magazine piece about having to make that separation. On a more joyful note, you are going to hear David Royko read what I have ever called the Christmas tree column, and he'll tell you why. We had the choice. I said, David, which one do you want to read, Mary and Joe or the Christmas tree column? He chose the Christmas tree column, and wherever his mom and dad are now, they'd be really, really proud, and we'll tell you why after a couple of commercials. Arguably,
he's the little boy that Santa Claus forgot.
That would be me, Rick Cogan, the little boy that Santa Claus forgot. I've been filling in for John Williams, the great new producer, new to WGN. Roe Coleman will post this show sometime in the next few days. And if you didn't hear it or want to share the musings of Father John Cusick with your friends, just go to WGNradio.com. Here, now, from a couple weeks ago, by popular demand of the listening public, is David Royko reading what I think is his father's, one of his father, Mike Royko's great columns. Next most moving column. David, you chose this for a specific reason, right? Not just that I think it's great.
Yeah, no, this is one of my favorite columns, too. And the thing is, what many people don't realize when they read this is that this is completely autobiographical. There are a couple of tiny tweaks, like when he refers to my mother is saying she's kind of pretty. That was
understatement.
I mean, I don't think Slats could have said she was a knockout bombshell and had the column have the same impact.
Here it is, ladies and gentlemen.
The conversation at the bar got around to Christmas trees. Somebody had mentioned how much they cost today and what a pain in the neck it is to go out in the bitter cold and shop around for a good one. Nah, said Slats Grobnik, there's nothing to it. Not if you know what you're doing. What makes you an expert? I used to work in a tree lot when I was a young guy, said Slats. My uncle used to sell them in the vacant lot next to his tavern. And that's when I learned the secret. What secret? The secret of having the most beautiful tree you ever saw. That's easy. The secret is to go out with a pocket full of money and spend what it takes to buy the best tree. Slats shook his head. Uh-uh. Money's not the secret. So, tell us the secret. All right. It was a long time ago, maybe 30 years. I was in the lot, and it was the night before Christmas Eve, about a half hour before I was going to help close up. I hadn't seen a customer in 2 hours. I had maybe a couple dozen trees left, and most of them weren't much to look at. By the time you get that close to Christmas, they've been picked over pretty good. So I'm standing by the kerosene heater when this young couple comes in and starts looking at the trees. I don't know them by name, but I know they live down the street in the basement of one of the dumpiest three flats in the neighborhood. He's a skinny young guy with a big Adam's apple and a small chin, not much to look at. She's kind of pretty, but they're both wearing clothes that they look like they came out of the bottom bin at the Salvation Army store. It's cold as a witch's toes, but neither of them have got on gloves or heavy shoes, so it's easy to see that they're having a hard time with their paychecks. Well, they start lifting the trees up and looking at them and walking around them the way people do. They finally find one that was pretty decent, not a great tree, but it wasn't bad, and they ask me the price. It was about $8 or $9. They don't say anything, they just put it down. They keep looking. They must have looked at every tree in the lot. Like I said, there weren't many that were good, but every time I gave the price at a decent one, they shook their heads. Finally, they thanked me and walked away. But when they got out to the sidewalk, she says something and they stand there talking for a while. Then he shrugs and they come back. I figure they're going to take one of the good trees after all. But they go over to the tree that had to be the most pathetic tree we had. It was a Scotch pine that was okay on one side, but the other side was missing about half the branches. They asked me how much that one was. I told them that they'd have a hard time making it look good no matter how much tinsel they put on it, but they could have it for a couple of bucks. Then they picked up another one that was damn near as pathetic. Same thing, full on one side but scraggly on the other. They asked how much for that one. I told them that it was a deuce, too. So then she whispers something to him, and he asks me if I'll take $3 for the two of them. Well, what am I going to do? Nobody's going to buy those trees anyway, so I told them they had a deal. But I tell them, what do you want with two trees? Spend a few dollars more and get yourself a nice tree. She just smiled and said they wanted to try something, so they gave me the $3, and he carried one of them, and she took the other. The next night, I happen to be walking past their building. I look down at their window, and I can see a tree. I couldn't see it all, but what there was looked good. The lights are on, so I figure, what the heck? I knock on the door. They open it, and I tell them I noticed the tree, and I was just curious. They let me in, and I almost fell over. There, in this tiny parlor, was the most beautiful tree I ever saw. It was so thick, it was almost like a bush. You couldn't see the trunk. They told me how they did it. They took the two trees and worked the trunks close together so they touched where the branches were thin. Then they tied the trunks together with wire. But when the branches overlapped and came together, it formed a tree so thick you couldn't see the wire. It was like a tiny forest of its own. The two of them looked so happy with it that it made me feel good the rest of the week. And thinking of those two orphan trees, which would have been tossed out if they hadn't come along, made me feel good too. So, that's the secret. You take two trees that aren't perfect, that have flaws, that might even be homely, that maybe nobody else would want. But if you put them together just right, you can come up with something really beautiful. Like two people, I guess.
And that column does me in, David Royko. It just does me in. It is as beautiful a kind of... The fact that it appeared in a newspaper is kind of shocking to me at this point. But it is just... And for you, it just got to be such an emotional kind of... It's got to be at the same time a kind of emotional punch in the gut, but also a like hand through your hair, too. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, it brings to life. I mean, yeah, you see pictures and things about your folks when they were younger. This brings them to life.
Yeah,
you know, it's you know,
it's really something. I got to tell you, this has been a great hour. I always like spending time with you, and it's often I've spent some, you know, a couple Christmases with your dad too. And he and I never dealt well with the holidays, but that's another matter for another time. David Royko, thank you. It is always a treat, and happy holidays. Merry Christmas to you and Karen and Ben and Jake and everybody else.
Well, the pleasure is all mine, and thank you.
The book, again, Perfect Christmas Gift, The Best of Royko, The Tribune Years. If you buy this book and don't have any other collections, you undoubtedly, this will be like your gateway drug to all the previous collections, because you can have them all. You can have them all. And it's a great idea to be a really wonderful thing to put under a Christmas tree, no matter what it looks like. Thanks for listening to those. You requested them. Those are two of the great Mike Royko columns. Very sensitive, very tender columns about the holidays, which with Mike and I and many other people don't deal that well. It's a very emotional time. As you heard John Cusack earlier in this show with me, Rick Cogan, filling in for John Williams, in his book, Never Be Ordinary, Wisdom from My Father, put him in touch with his late father, who died when John was only 25 years old. And if you just heard David Royko talking, that column that he read about the two young people without very much money going out and searching for a Christmas tree and buying two and putting them together puts David, who's no kid, in touch with his departed parents. We'll take a little commercial break, then I'll sign off and wish you all a Merry Christmas Eve and a Merry Christmas. Well, Ben Cortez, I will make my formal goodbyes to you and your WGN career on Friday when I'm filling in for John again. And we'll have in here some barkeepers, and maybe they'll bring you a drink. Ro Coleman, thank you so much for producing. You're a new star at this station. Brian Noonan's going to take over now. You are going to keep driving and have a great Christmas Eve. Be kind to your relatives. And Brian, I'm sure you're on all the way till 7.
No. Hi, Rick.
Hi.
Merry Christmas.
You too.
How are
pal?
You? No, good. We are on until 6 today.
Okay.
Because then the Christmas spectacular begins on WGN.
The Christmas extravaganza.
Yes.
They're replaying This Is a Wonderful Life 1,000 times on WGN. Brian, happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you as well. We'll talk soon.
You bet.